We've got a real treat for you listeners of Rediscovered Radio, Women's Voices, Women's Music in the WISO archives. Jocelyn Robinson here, radio preservationist and producer, and with my co-host Juliet Frumholt, WISO's music director, we've got another bonus episode for you. Sharon Lane is a longtime Dayton music legend, but she's also a storyteller par excellence, and man, does she have some tales to tell. That's what makes her music so special. She and I go way back. Back to her early years at Canal Street's Musicians Co-op, and that's a story in itself. But her connection to that special listening room and to its owner, Mick Montgomery, go back even farther. You're going to hear all that and more. It's the Sharon Lane story, and I'm so glad I can share it with y'all. But first, let's open with a little original Sharon Lane composition from the WISO archives. Here she is, along with her musical partner, Danny Sowers, blowing the sax, performing at the Women in Music 25th Anniversary Concert back in December of 2000. She's introduced here by Women in Music co-hosts Pam Canine and Corey Slavitt.
Sharon, good job. You're playing tonight at Canal Street Tavern. Tell us a little bit about that gig.
Well, it's their anniversary too, 19 years.
It was a good year.
Yeah, it was. You know, I always say, let me tell you, if they can turn time back an hour, whoever they might be, then why can't we just go back to about 1967? That was a great year, don't you think?
Ooh, I don't know. High school. For some of us.
I know. Not for me either.
What are you going to play next?
A song called Rooster, because we don't know how to title our songs, so we just call them the obvious thing. And that's like the working title, and then it becomes a real thing because we can't think of anything else. So we're going to do Rooster. Actually, this is just to pay tribute to a time passing to where we didn't have alarm clocks. We just kind of did it by animals and smell and seasons. And so this is about a rooster that lost his job. And the rooster forgot to crow. Wait a minute, Mr. Rooster. Can you tell me what's wrong? Yeah. Put me out of work. It happened such a long time ago. Well, I ain't got no reason. Gonna make me wanna grow. And no, I ain't gonna grow. Well, it used to be such a proud old rooster, yeah. Well, he could crow for days. He kept his barnyard looking good. He kept it fine in every way. Thank you.
Just tell me the Sharon Lane story. If we were pitching a biopic, what would the story be?
Probably one of the most important things that ever happened to me is that my dad's sister played piano at church. And I'm little, and I was fascinated with the piano. Just absolutely thought it was the coolest thing in the whole world, even though I probably couldn't have said it was the coolest thing in the whole world then. I was just taken by it. And so I can remember I always related to being about 3 years old somewhere. I wasn't four, and so I had to be around three. But I would go over and I'd stand as tall as I could, put my hands up and make the notes go down. And I always, always just thought that was the coolest thing in the whole world, is that piano. So I fell in love with the piano at that time. Now, when I was about eight, I got to have a piano in the home. My dad made sure that I had one, and I started playing. I took piano lessons when I was eight for about a year, but the teacher, we parted ways in a kind way. He basically told my mom, she's not going to listen. She doesn't want to read the book. This isn't what she wants. And that was okay. That was okay with me. And then my dad also gave me his old guitar. So I played guitar. I knew three chords. Okay, I learned three chords, and I played every song with three chords. And if there was a change that I didn't understand, I would just make a big strum, and then I would sing the change and then come back in. I thought that was so cool, because I thought that covered up the fact that I didn't know that. But growing up with a dad that, my dad always called him a cowboy dad. He loved cowboy songs, and he loved hillbilly music. My mom loved hillbilly music in 50s. My mom turned me on to every artist in the whole complete world in the 50s, and would jitterbug with pillows and me at times. So I grew up with people that loved music, that listened intently to music, but also played a little bit, And when my mother remarried after my parents divorced some years down the road, when she remarried, she married a man that loved big band and jazz music. And so he turned me on to that. I probably would have never known who Mr. Armstrong was had it not been for him, and Nancy Wilson and Ella Fitzgerald and, all of those wonderful people that were doing their thing. Then Peggy Lee, he turned me on to Peggy Lee and all those folks. And so I feel like, and then being a 60s baby, I feel like I was kind of born in the right time, because I just had all of these genres of music, that influenced me somehow, whether it be singing or playing or whatever. So I learned that it was real easy to put a guitar on my back and hitchhike somewhere and sit with people that were playing or whatever. And I did, I think I'm lying. I always say I made $5 my first paid gig, but I think I made about two. Who knows? And it was right here in Yellow Springs. I played over at the college, and I actually made a little money. Then hitchhiked home and thought I was a big star. Played every Hank Williams tune in the key of G. But that was really my young story. And as I got older, I was in bands. But there, the situation back when I was growing up was that music was a hobby. It wasn't anything that you pursued. And yet even what you would pursue was different than, I was to get married and have kids and, make brownies or whatever that was supposed to be, So even playing music when I was young, family-wise and things like that, even community-wise, it wasn't accepted well,
You know, it's like, put that away. Do that after the kids go to bed. You know, oh, you can play in your living room. And that's what I did. I got married because I thought, well, that's what you do. And so the whole music thing was, oh, man, I'd still play in the living room, you know, a little bit. But then I started doing a little band work, you know, and then my husband and I had a band then, and I that was it. I started playing out, and that was a whole different being way, a different way of being received, I think probably is the best way to put it. And of course, it was the 60s, you know, and the 60s were crazy, and new things being tried, and people living differently and thinking differently and being vocal about it. And we had the world situations. We had the United States, you know, civil rights, and we had the Vietnam War, and those were huge concerns then, and women's rights. And I didn't know women had any, so, you know, it's like, okay, I'll join this one. And, of course, what that played into the whole music scene, you know. And so, oh, my goodness, you can't be doing that. You know, go back in the closet. That's not what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be a mom and wash dishes and work at the local restaurant or something, you know. And so I, you know, there was different times where I stepped back and I didn't do a whole lot. I was still writing, though. I stayed with that because that could be kept in a book hidden in the closet. So I did that.
So you were in Dayton?
Yes, I was in Dayton, you know, I was in Dayton, yeah. I've been in Dayton all of, most of my life. I don't even want to go into that, but, you know, it was a split between going home and my home, I consider Kentucky. I was born here. I was born in a hospital. That was a real big deal. My mom always said that she had to hold off because she didn't want me born in Cincinnati because she thought Cincinnati was dirty. And so she came to Dayton where it was clean because it was a gem city. And so I actually have been, I was born here, but those days were different. I spent a lot of time, kind of split the year between here and there. And, you know, that was still part of that great migration, you know, that came here for people like my dad who worked at General Motors and did not want to be a coal miner. You know, and my mom used to always say, I wouldn't spend a coal miner's money. And things like being able to go to a doctor when you wanted to. You picked up the phone and made an appointment. You didn't have to wait for the doctor to come through your little town once a year. Or being able to go to a supermarket and not having to milk the cow. Now I wish we were still milking cows. But, you know, that modern 50s life after the war, you know, was a real big calling too. And so, but there was a guilt among Appalachian people because they moved away from home. And so your kids went home for about 5 or 6 months out of the year so that they were working. You know, you worked your kids. My grandma used to say that's the only reason you had kids was to work them, you know. And so so then I quit doing those jaunts when I was about 14. You know, once you start looking at, once you start falling in love or you have a social life of your own that you can make somewhat. And I was busy in school doing all kinds of stuff, and I didn't go like that anymore, although I still, Kentucky is my home. That's what I call home, and I feel at home when I'm there.
So what schools did you go to?
Well, here in Dayton, Ohio, I went to Fairport Elementary, and that's where I met Mick Montgomery. Nick, I think he was in the third grade. His brother is, say, fourth, but I don't know, third, fourth grade, and I was in kindergarten. And I fell off the jungle gym and buggered up my knee and just stood there crying like kids do, like an angel's going to come down and save them, I guess. Mick came home and said, took me by the hand and said, you really need to go in and see your teacher and get that knee, you know, get a Band-Aid, I think is what he said. And he took me in the room. And that's how I met Meg Montgomery. Honest to goodness. So I went to Fairport Elementary. That was an 8-year school. And my parents moved to Troutwood. And I went to Madison High School. Troutwood Madison High School. Yeah. And so that, and then, you know, and then I wasn't reared that we went to college. That's, so I didn't even think about going to college. I just was glad to get out of high school and take off and do what I want to do, and found out that I may want to do it, but the world didn't want me to. And kind of went through those trials and tribulations of really finding out where women's places were at that time. Became very evident.
Tell me about that. What was that? What, do you remember having an awakening? Do you remember what that was like?
I don't know if I can pinpoint one thing, but getting a credit card. You can get credit cards, and you had to have a man sign for your credit card. Yet when I was married and I had credit cards in my name, when we got divorced, he got the credit. I had none. The minute I walked out of the courthouse, even though I was the one paying them, even though my name was on it, I had no credit. And that was an eye awakening. In music, the eye awakening was you had to be a minus zero. You couldn't weigh more than 2 pounds, seemed like. You know, you had to be ultra skinny and a lot of sequins, and you didn't move much. You sang, but you weren't allowed to kick your legs or anything like that. You had to stand real still. And you could move a little, but and you had to have big hair. I remember if you had big hair, you were in like Flint. And then the music industry, you know, they wanted pretty girls that acted proper in front of people. So being young and in the music thing and hitchhiking, when I would hitchhike, you know, that was like looked upon, what are you doing here? You're female, and what are you doing? And this is stupid, and why does your parents know where you are? And all of, and sometimes a little scary, because if you were out hitchhiking, then you had to be a loose person. That means that anybody could have their way, maybe. But there was so much going on, then, you know, the fighting to, like we're still doing, fighting to have the right to call our own bodies and do what we need to do with our bodies, you know, and being made aware of that and going, what? And I can remember a lot of times I'd just be like, is this for real? You're this old and you're just now finding out about this. Civil rights. You know, I say all the time, you know, when I was growing up, I it was segregated. You know, we lived in a segregated world. I mean, you know, I went to an all-white school. I think we had 2 Mexican people there, you know, kids. And and if you went to your local library, you could get a book about Harriet Tubman. You could get a book about George Washington Carver. Boom, that was it. So, you know, I'm listening to music being made by these incredible black artists and had no idea who they were, where they came from, what their life was about, or all these wonderful inventors, you know, that were black inventors, and I wasn't allowed to know about them. I wasn't allowed to know anything about them. There was nothing. You went to the library, there was nothing. And I remember I found a book. God, I was so young. And it was about this little Mexican boy. And I remember thinking, oh my goodness, there's a world out there that I'm not allowed to know about. There's a whole world of beautiful, these beautiful people and all this music and all this stuff, and I'm not allowed to know anything about them. So that was an eye-opener for me. That was a real eye-opener. You know, lots of rude awakenings as a young person and as I got older, going, oh my goodness.
Okay, so you're a young mother, you're making a little music, you get divorced, and do you start making more music?
Yeah. Well, there's lots of things that play into that, which I'm not even going to go into. But again, that bigotry about being a woman and playing in bands and playing in bars and traveling with four or five guys in a van or whatever, there was a lot of stigma for women doing that. You had to be doing drugs, or you know, you had to be out of your mind, you had to be loose, you had to be all those things that at that time, if you were called that, was very hurtful. It's still hurtful. I mean, it's a hurtful thing to be called things that you're not anyhow, you know. And I had this little girl that I was going to be rearing by myself pretty much, you know, a part-time, every other weekend father sometimes. And the one thing that I don't regret is she needed a home. All kids need that security of having a place. At least I felt that way. And so I had the house, and she had a swing set. And what I found, well, I just didn't even think about this at first, because I just sat down at the piano and just started writing music and writing songs and singing for me and my daughter, whether she liked it or not. She was my audience, you know. And I had started working at Canal Street Tavern for Mick, you know, all these years later. And I was working, and my goal was to get a set put together that I could go do somewhere, you know, and be proud of it and not make mistakes and not shake all over the place. And you know, it's hard when you're a solo performer. You don't have anybody to blame your mistakes on but yourself. You can't blame them on the guitar man or anybody else. So it really was as simple as this. Mick kind of knew, because that old piano that Pete Bradstreet had parked into Canal Street, when things were at a low or I'd take a break, I'd go play it, you know, and I'd play a song that I'd written or something. And so one day Mick says, I think it's time that you do a gig. I think it's time. And I can't, you know what, for the life of me, I cannot remember who my first gig was opening for. I can't remember that. But I said, no, I don't think I'm ready for that. And he said, well, it's too late. I put your name in the paper. You're going to do it. And I remember I thought, well, I didn't know whether to just pass out or throw up, you know.
What year was that?
1982. I'm so bad with years, but I'm hoping that I'm telling you it was at least 1982, maybe, that I, 83, he had been open for a little bit. I know that. So somewhere in there. And I did it, and I was hooked on it. And the thing that opened up for me then was that I was meeting so many incredible artists that I'd only read in Teen Magazine or something, one of those music magazines for kids, you know, that I couldn't believe it and could actually sit down and have a human conversation with these people and ask questions which some of those people I formed such a good relationship with and friendship with, that opened doors for me to play other places. And so I started doing openers there, and pretty soon I was doing the Musicians Co-op all the time. So actually, you know, I started running the Musicians Co-op, and that was perfect because I could play, because a lot of times people didn't show up, and what I did was work wonderful duets with people, and I met people, and I was kind of backwards. You know, I'd go to Sam's and not talk to anybody and stand in the corner and watch the act and then leave before everybody else did, kind of thing. So I'm not even looked at one of those Sam's people because nobody knew me and I hid, you know. And it just blossomed into some really good things for me, doing the Musicians Co-op and seeing how to run that and meeting people and trying to give them slots and times and encouragement and slots and times that they could hone their craft. And that's what I was doing. I'd get up there any chance I got, and I would play, and I'd try a new song out in front of people and see how well it went over or whatever, you know, and then eventually managing Canal Street.
I can remember you doing that.
Yeah.
I can remember, you know, some Tuesday nights where you got up there and did a thing that it's like, I just wrote this. I don't know what it's going to be like. I'm just going to do it. And
yeah,
I can remember that.
And then I'd say, okay, I'd go home and I'd go, three people out of what, maybe 50, 60 people clapped. So maybe I need to work on this one a little bit more. Yeah.
Let's talk about what it was like for women musicians playing out over the years. Tell me how that kind of evolved from your perspective.
Well, I wanted to say this. In the 60s, I'll tell you, Janis Joplin, and almost, you know, it's like I was compared to her a lot as far as it was the gravel in my voice, nothing else. But Janis Joplin allowed me to believe that white women could do blues, and it was okay. And you know, Tracy Nelson allowed me to know that white women could sing blues, and it was okay. And so women playing, money was always screwed. They could give you a guarantee. I mean, one of the worst arguments I ever had is that I had a pretty good guarantee for that time. And at the end of the night, I was like, well, you know, I can't give you that. Here's that. And I'm just like, that's not going to happen. This is what you said, and this is what I expect. And he's, why have bills to pay? And I'm like, I don't. Are you crazy? I pay the same bills you do, you know? And so I think pay is still a big problem in this world for women. Pay, if a band was making $500 a night, you know, and you were a woman with the same guys, you were making $350 a night, you know? And so the pay, or at the end of the night, even if they offered you the same amount of money, at the end of the night, it was a whole different ball game. And a lot of your places you would go to, again, that stigma back then of, well, you're out running around, you know the world, so hey, baby, kind of feel to it. A lot of times, you know, it's, yeah, I'm going to pay you, but let's do this first, kind of thing. I ran into a few of those, and, you know, even when people would say, what are you doing this for? Why don't you go home? Go home. Take care of your man. Why aren't you? You shouldn't be home. You shouldn't be running around doing all this stupid stuff. Go home. Raise a kid. Clean your house. You know, kind of thing. So there. But I don't want it to sound as though everyone was that way, because I played some places that it was just wonderful, and people were just people and kind and generous in spirit. But you ran into those things every now and then.
Did you feel Did you feel safe most of the time?
I'm going to laugh at that because, see, I was so naive at one point that I thought, well, I don't want to hurt anybody, so why would anybody want to hurt me? I'm not a threat. I'm just me. And so I was so naive to it. I felt pretty safe for a long time because I was too stupid to know I shouldn't be, I guess. Really, that's just kind of the truth of it. And then as I got older and saw different things and heard different stories, or perhaps had one of those stories of my own with a little bit of weirdness to it, I thought, oh, maybe you just shouldn't be so like you are. Maybe you need to pay attention to what's going on around you, and maybe not everybody has your best interest at heart, you know, and so maybe you need to pay attention and at least be aware, you know, be aware of who you're with. And if your gut tells you something, don't slough it off, you know. So, yeah, there was those days where I got older, as I say. You know, I got older in the business, and I knew not everybody was out for my best interest, you know.
Yeah. Do you think that that happened more for women than for men?
Yeah. Because I think, as silly as this may sound, and as just bottom into it, it's like still, you know, fellas can get old in this business. And the older they get, there's a different regard. And there's a, they can have 20 wrinkles on one eyeball, one eyelid, and they become more handsome. And look at them, how virile they are. You know, look at Mick Jagger being 80 years old and he's still doing it. But, and there's women that go, oh, he's so sexy. But a woman that gets older, and I think it's changed some, but a woman that gets older in certain genres, they're just old. And they can still kick their leg up over their head, but it doesn't matter. You know, they're old. And so I do still think that there's some of that goes on as far as people putting money to back you if your desire is to be a top recording artist or whatever. There's still a whole lot of that. Body shaming and all of that stuff. I do think it's easier for fellas. Well, I mean, still look at it. If you go see a band, how many all-girl bands do you see? How many bands do you see where it's all women? You still have bands that the majority of the band is made up by males. And I certainly don't want it to ever sound like I don't love my men in music, because I do. But I think that when you're in a band and you got a bunch of guys around you, it's made easier for you as a woman, because you got your brothers. You know, all you have to do is say, hey, you know, somebody's going to come save you, you know, and or get you out of a situation. I know that one of the things, I can tell a story. I was in Alabama, and that's all I'm going to say, and I was by myself. And at that time, I was trying that little thing of having like an, there was a gentleman who booked me. And I drive out, and I find this place, and it's like Porky's. Did you ever see that movie, Porky's? It's out in the middle of nowhere, just by itself. And I thought, I can't be playing here. This can't be the place. So I go in, and there's this big old fella, and I tell him who I am, and that I'm going to be playing there. And I ask for someone to help me bring my equipment in. I had, you know, equipment's still heavy, but boy, back then. And basically was told, well, y'all wanted rights. Y'all want this women's lib crap. So bring it in your damn self. So I'm hauling equipment in by myself. And I had asked him, of course, this is way before cell phones. You know, and I asked him if I could use his phone that I had a card to reverse the charges, and it was on a pole out in the parking lot. The only phone was, I said, do you do your business? Yeah, he just goes out there, makes phone calls. And I'm thinking, this is like not right. This is like this can't be true. I'm living in the Twilight Zone. And so I did the gig to an audience of people that I thought I don't know if anybody clapped or not. I don't think there was one person clapped for a song. It was just kind of quiet and weird. And I got out of there. And I was supposed to stay. You know, back then when you traveled, you could get in-house stay. Somebody take you to their house. You know, I did that with traveling people at Canal Street. We've all done that. And I was supposed to stay with some people, but the whole night turned out so weird. I went, oh, I'm sorry, I got a gig at it, and I have to leave. I thought, I could die here. They'd be burying me out in the parking lot under the damn phone. No one's going to know where I am. But I see where I see good changes. There's still good changes happening, and especially for young women that I see. And I celebrate that. Oh. I celebrate that. I did a few years back, I did with a gentleman, I did an interview, and he said, so how does it look in your area for music? He says, are we in trouble? And I'm like, oh, no, we're not in trouble. We have some of the finest people here, and we've always in this area had some of the best music ever and musicians. But right now we have this... Ooh, the women are popping, man. They're doing great things. And that just makes my heart full. You know, that just makes me so full to see that.
Well, we'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. But first, I would like you to talk about the Dayton music scene as it relates to women. And, you know, kind of think about what it was like back in the 80s. You know, we've talked a little bit about that, but I'd really like to know, too, the role of open stages to that music ecosystem. What was special about open stages like the Musicians Co-op and like the Dayton Women's Music Collective?
Well, of course, what I tell you is my opinion and how I saw it. I can't do it any other way, but the Musicians Co-op, you know, Mick Montgomery started the Musicians Co-op at Sam's. And when he opened up Canal Street Tavern, he brought it with him. And I think he hosted it for maybe not even a full year, I don't think. But every week, I think the thing that means the most about it is that, and I used to remind people of this, you are on the same stage that people like Taj Mahal and Paul Butterfield and all of these wonderful artists that had so-called made it. You know, you're sitting on the same stage. The guy running your sound is the same guy that just ran Larry Sparks and all of these bluegrass people and rock and roll, you know, people and Jesse Colin Youngs and all of these wonderful artists. You've got the same sound person and you're sitting on the same stage that those folks did. And that's where you are now. So that makes you special. That makes you special. Not, aren't you thrilled that you get to do that? It's just you get the same respect and the same regard on this stage. And the fact that you didn't have to be a professional musician, maybe you're the man or the woman that had been playing in their basement or their living room or garage or whatever it was, and didn't have an outlet to even see if you wanted to be on a stage and do it. And you honed your craft. Some people went and they went, I'm okay, you know. But some people went on to really pursue this dream in music. And they went on to form bands. And so many of those bands met as solo performers on those stages and hooked up and became bands. And at the same time, we had professional musicians that were coming in and sitting on that stage and sharing their talent in a way that the people that were honing their talent could see the difference between amateur and professional without anybody trying to say anything and pound it in their head. They could see it. They could experience it and go, oh, that's how you do that. They learned how to talk to sound men, sound people. You know, they learned sometimes, some people came in didn't even know what a monitor was, let alone anything else. And they learned how to use the language. So it was kind of a learning situation in many ways. And yet, there again, just being able to share your talent. And how many people would jump up and sing harmony, and people that had never sang together, all of a sudden they know that John Prine tune and they're up there singing. It was just a real family feel to it, and opened the doors for a lot of people, I think, you know.
So what are your memories of the Dayton Women's Music Collective?
A lot of fond memories. I met a lot of really cool women that I would have never known had I not met them at the Women's Collective, and made friendships with a lot of people I would have never, ever had an opportunity to meet. And I think that Meg Montgomery, I did not know of any other club owner, venue owner, that opened up their doors and invited music that was performed, written by, and allowed those incredible performers to share their music and not have to change pronouns at that time. You know, that welcome, he didn't really care if you were a lesbian. He didn't care if you were gay. He didn't care all about all those words. Yeah. What he did care about is that good music was being presented. And what he did care about was having an opportunity to provide a space for that. And really, just like the open, you know, the musicians' co-op, you know, it was an opportunity for young women to open for women who were, should have been applauded way louder and way harder and way more than what they had been in our area. Now, I don't know. I know that other areas were different, but I know in Dayton, Ohio, it was a whole different ballgame. And he was cool enough to do that and provide that.
You know, I think that the relationships that I still have with a handful of folks from that time, they were really, really formative. I mean, they really did help me figure out, you know, who do I want to be? How do I want to move through the world? You know, I was in my, you know, mid to late 20s and hit 30 during the 80s. And, you know, it took me even years beyond that to really get it as figured out as I did at the time. It's still a process. I'm still trying to figure it out.
Me too. But, you know, I think with me, I kind of came into this. You can figure it out. At least for me. I can't talk for anybody else. I know that a lot of us have the same experiences, but how we relate to those and how we handle those and how we're still handling those is going to be different. But I'll tell you what, I gave myself all this stuff I figured out, all these things that I thought I had figured out, and I did in a lot of cases. I finally gave myself permission to achieve them and to do them and to have them. And that took a lot of years for me. And like I said, you said you're still, so am I. I think that's called growth. And I think people do that till they can't grow anymore. But giving yourself permission and you know, I will cheerlead people and then turn around sometimes and go, wow, you were just like cheerleading that person and pushing them forward. And now I want you to do that for you on this or in this situation? Why didn't you do that for you? Or why aren't you doing that for you now? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're born. It's given to you. It's inside of you. The minute you come out of your mother's womb, and that's this, the first time you ever pull yourself, this is when it becomes evident, you pull yourself up to that coffee table, and you got a big grin on your face because you're standing up and you think you're so cool. All your parents have to do is turn on a song, and your little butt's going up and down, and they're laughing, and you're laughing, and they're clapping, and you're clapping, and the more they laugh and grin and clap, the more you do it. And then pretty soon, you're standing up, and your little butt's going up and down, you're dancing, and now you're singing. La, 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 la. And your parents are clapping, and you're excited, and you're dancing, and you're laughing. And I said, by the time you're 4 years old, you'll give that away, and you won't do it anymore. And they're like, what? You won't do it anymore because you're afraid somebody's going to laugh at you. So you quit doing it, and you give away freedom of dance, and you give away freedom of singing. Don't let that happen. Take it back. If you're one of those people that gave it up when you're 4 years old, get it back. Take it back. Don't worry about what anybody else does. Don't worry about anybody laughing at you. Who cares? Who cares? It's probably somebody that won't dance because they gave it up when they were three. You know, don't do that.
Well, I think that, you know, I'm getting close to the end of the questions that I have. I think, you know, as a somebody who mentors and who supports, what advice do you have for women musicians today?
Stay true to who you are. Don't worry about if you don't sound like someone else or you don't play like someone else. And if you've got that burning desire, stay true to it. Don't let anybody do. I used to tell my kids this too. Don't let an adult take that away from you. Don't listen to them. I don't care if it's your mom, if your dad, your brother, your sister, your next door neighbor. You hold on to that flame. And when you need help, you reach out and take it. Go to someone you trust. So if you need help and you want someone to help you in your music or your painting or whatever it is that you choose to do, know who to reach out to. And don't let anybody take that away from you. And work hard at it. You're allowed to. Your dishes will always be there. Your dishes will be in the sink when you get done writing that song. Your clothes will go into the hamper eventually. You know, prioritize. You are allowed to prioritize your talent no matter what that is, no matter what you choose. So if it's the arts that you choose, you are allowed to prioritize that. Even if you're a wife, even if you're a mother, even if your dishes are dirty, even if you have a flat tire on your car, finish the song first, paint the picture first. You're allowed to do that. Do not let anyone convince you that it's a hobby. You'll know if it's a hobby. You'll know if it's something you want to do in your spare room and you don't care if you ever show the picture or you ever sing in front of that, you'll know that, and that'll be your choice. But don't let someone take it from you, ever, ever. Hold on with both hands and learn how to cuss a lot.
Can you give me a ride? Three little babies depending on you. One goes here, the other one goes there. Lord, this one don't hang with me. Well, I need a drink. Well, can't you see that?
We're going out with some more vintage Sharon Lane, performing with Danny Sowers from the Women in Music Anniversary Concert. It's a tune called Cabbie. And if you haven't already, subscribe to Women's Voices, Women's Music in the WYSO archives wherever you get your podcasts. Like us, review us, share us. There's more Rediscovered Radio coming up soon, so stay close.
Hey there, Mr. Open this door real fast. Well, I swear I think there's somebody trying to get to me. There's an extra 20 in this cabby gig of yours. You can get me out of here on quick. Help me in, I'm old. And it ain't safe for me to be standing out here. I need to go two blocks the other way to see my friend. Ain't no tip for you today. Thank you very much.